streets.
Okay, welcome.
Talking and then they disperse.
This is the panel entitled Reading the Struggles. And Sylvia Federici was to be here today with me. She's not going to be able to make it this evening. But we also have another panel or gathering tomorrow at 10 o'clock, and she will be there then. So again, she sends her apologies. And so if people have come to see her, you'll have a chance to see her tomorrow. Okay. Today, I'd like to, I'm here for a variety of reasons. First, of course, just to be at the Book Fair, to be with comrades here from many parts of the world, but including and especially people from New York. And I'm also here because I've been for the last 30 years a member of the Midnight Notes Collective. And this is a year where a number of comrades are coming back together again, and we've made a lot of new friends, and in the process have been putting together an analysis of the contemporary crisis. A number of us thought that this would be a great place to begin a discussion of this this effort. And come on in. You want to come in? Okay. It would be a good place to have a discussion of this this effort. We're going to do a little bit of it today. But also, there's been a suggestion that, and it's sort of a challenge, you might say, that has been posed by one a very close comrade of ours, who was asked to have me explain something that whenever he's heard me talk, I've brought up. Because often I said, we can't begin to discuss this unless we read the struggles. And I say this all the time, whenever there's a political question coming up, that's my sort of routine answer. So I was asked to make sense of what that means. What do I mean by this idea that in order to do any kind of political analysis, in order to begin to strategize politically, it's crucial to start with the struggles and a reading of them. So how do you read struggles, and what's the point of reading struggles? So the first part of what I wanted to deal with today is just to sketch out a few ideas about what it means to read struggles, and then to sort of expand a bit longer. I'll take a little more time. And I was hoping maybe you can give me a sense of what time it is. Okay. Okay. I'm going to need a watch of some sort. Okay. Thanks a lot. Because I'd like to, we have till 6 o'clock, right? So I'd like to take some time to explain what I mean by reading the struggles and read a few struggles as well. And then open up our discussion. But of course, anytime you have questions or any thoughts that you'd like to have dealt with immediately, say so, and we can do our best. By the way, this is being recorded, right? Now, I'm not sure if everyone is comfortable with it being recorded. Is everyone okay with it? Okay. All right, fine. Okay, now, one way of talking about struggle, or as this friend of and comrade of mine has called it, struggle literacy, keeping along with this notion of reading a struggle, the first point just to make is that struggles cannot be taken at their face value. And this is for two obvious reasons. First, that their self-definition is often either deliberately or unconsciously mistaken. In other words, often those who are involved in the struggle don't want to say what they're doing. Just put it in a simple light. And an enormous amount of struggle is not identified as struggle at all. Okay? In fact, for example, in housework, in street operations of all sorts, in schools, in factories, in offices, how, for example, do you read of peasant rebellions that take a mythical religious patron as a symbol? Is that a struggle? Is that a class struggle? How do you read women refusing to have sexual intercourse on a mass scale, leading to a population decline? Is that class struggle? Many of these, if you call them class struggles, don't call themselves class struggles. Right? But they're struggles indeed. It is in the nature of struggles between those who have different levels of power that the struggles be mischaracterized, since this mischaracterization is another move in the struggle itself. Consequently, reading the struggles is absolutely necessary, especially in a class society where they permeate almost every facet of life, but do not reveal their name. Okay? So this is the point why you have to be a little bit literate to read a struggle, because they don't present themselves, and they can't. It's in the nature of this sort of thing. Second thing that I want to just bring out is, and I use these words in a kind of loose fashion, there's a sociological as well as a political way of reading struggles, or the what for of the reading. The reading of struggles can be done social scientifically or politically. The social scientific reading arises from the attitude of the state and capital to class struggles. Their intent is to objectify, evade, recuperate, and repress these struggles. A political reading of the struggles is based upon the perspective of furthering their revolutionary potentialities. In other words, the struggle asks you to make a decision if you're going to read them. It's like, it's a book that takes you by the collar and says, are you for me or are you against me? Are you working for me or are you working against me? And that this is part of the reading that you have to make a decision about. Often sociological readings of struggles are very informative. It's like any good spy who gives a spy's report, right? It could be very interesting, and it's interesting to have a spy read what a spy has to say when you're in a meeting that you're being reported about. Very interesting. But that's something quite different than reading the struggle that you're involved with and seeing what can be done to make it succeed, what can be done to make it a revolutionary struggle. That's a choice that every reader must make. And the third thing that I just need to bring out about struggles and reading them is that many struggles are quite visible, but an enormous amount of struggle is invisible. Okay, sometimes it involves what some have called weapons of the weak. Sometimes it involves everyday life. Sometimes it involves what is called the microsocial, the labor process, the moral economy, rhizomatic area of life. Since 1968. There have been a wide variety of analyses of struggles that have led to the recognition that there's a density of class struggle in all social space. It's dense. It's the dark matter of social life that accounts for the fact that not all goes well for the ruling classes, even when there are neither formal strikes nor rebellions nor revolts. This is an area that requires a sharp eye and a sensitive ear, this area of invisibility, of the dark matter of struggle. Since the struggle is literally fractional in terms of gestures and ironic in terms of words. So you have to hear very carefully and sharpen your ear. Now, one of the important aspects of reading struggles is whether they're autonomous from they have an autonomous character, or they're absorbed by the system that they're struggling against. Okay? Now, the first thing you have to realize that is that this notion of autonomy, which is a very powerful idea, has had many different meanings. And I sat down one day a couple of years ago and came up with six or seven of these readings. And I just thought that it might be useful for you to hear a couple of them, a few of them. One, for example, the ability of workers not to be defined by the laws of capital and to transcend the confines of their role as a dependent variable in the surplus value producing machine. Okay, in other words, there are struggles where workers present themselves not as involved, not as ruled by capital, but in fact open up other possibilities outside of the rule of capital. Two, the attempt by Italian extra-parliamentary leftists to go beyond the contract into the territory in the early 1970s, where they begin a whole set of struggles that move out of the factories into the social world, involving, for example, self-reduction of rents, of electrical bills, by self-reduction, meaning we pay what we believe to be fair, and collectively, together, we pay, if we are to pay. Okay. Now, the notion of autonomy here is the autonomy of leaving the factory and spreading the struggle to the whole social realm, beyond the confines of the factory struggle. Feminists have used the notion of autonomy, and they've argued that women should make their own political decisions independently of male organizations. There was the famous autonomy of the squatters movement in Europe, especially in Berlin, but also in other centers, that rejected any negotiations with city authorities and other traditional left unions and parties. There are many, many notions of autonomy, and I thought that this would be useful for us to recognize that there are these many subtleties, but I thought that I'd like to make a stab, along with my comrades and friends in Midnight Notes, to speak a little bit about the notion of autonomy or struggles that are inside and outside of capital in order to kind of clarify how you might read them. Okay? One of the most important distinctions to make, but most difficult to draw, is that between those struggles that are inside, sometimes we call them social democratic, and those that are autonomous or outside. In a way, this distinction is a variant of the one between reform and revolution in the early part of the 20th century. The inside-outside distinction, however, is not a spatial one, but one of political relation. Inside means demands, inside struggles means demands on a state or market institution that is normally dedicated to reproducing the labor-capital relation, while outside means communal appropriation of de- or non-commodified resources, perhaps in parallel with formal demands. Either can happen anywhere, just as commons can be maintained or created anywhere. The two aspects of inside and outside can be complementary or contradictory. For example, appropriation can be enhanced and or undermined by demands made on an institution. Either can be means to building alliances and expressing needs beyond those that are being made. By analyzing inside and outside relations and potentials in specific contexts, the movement can clarify its struggles. In other words, here you have an important question whenever you look at a struggle is, where is it operating? Is it operating outside? Is it attempting to immediately decommodify life, decommodify resources? Or is it accepting the logic within the system but pushing that logic? Now, many of us love the purity of the outside, right? And many of us would like to demand a life that's decommodified from this second on. And that is a powerful element that changes the world. That's true. But there are, of course, struggles, and they must be recognized, that are within this system. That do, in fact, when they move and transform whole masses of people, do change the system as well. So it's important to recognize that many times struggles that start from the inside can become outside struggles. And of course, to remember vice versa. And this is something that's been well discussed, and I know all of you have, in one way or another, dealt with struggles that have been, that start off very much outside and that are dragged back in. Again and again, that process is so basic. So, in terms of, just wanted to say a few more distinctions about reading. Struggle is not war, okay? The notion of struggle is used to indicate an antagonism that is not absolute, at least in its intent, as the one evoked by war. For war is based upon the intention of the complete annihilation of the antagonist. Struggles presuppose the existence of the antagonist, of the agonists, those who are in struggle, in their agony, and that they will continue to exist at the end of the agon, of the struggle. In fact, the agon was largely seen as an alternative to war. Thus, the Olympics in the ancient days in Greece were the time of peace among the city-states, a rare moment. So, it's true that when struggles accumulate, when they begin to add on to each other, struggles can be transformed into war and can lead to the annihilation of one of the agonists or both. Now, let me just say a few more points about this. Is everyone okay with this? We're going to have a little bit of a couple more points that I wanted to make about some ideas that have been very, very basic to the reading of struggle that I've been involved in for a number of decades now. And I think that might be useful to hear in your struggles, in reading your struggles, in starting your struggles. And this is the notions that are revolved around the notion of class composition and how class composition is brought out by struggles. Just as capital and the capitalist class has an internal structure that is complex and alive, that is, each different branch of capitalist industry has a different organic composition of capital that has a technical as well as a value expression. These are words that are coming directly out of Marx, okay? In other words, Marx looks at the system of production and says it's sort of alive, right? Human beings are there, but human beings are mixed up. They're the organic part of a mix which also deals with machines and with other. Excuse me. Okay. Bear with me another 10 minutes or so, and I'll be finished. Yes. So this world of production has living as well as dead parts of that are mixed together, right? It has an organic composition, as it called it. So too does labor and the working class. To understand working class composition is crucial to understanding class struggles. For struggle reveals the compositional character of workers. Indeed, in the definition that I started out with, this is how I sort of cut my teeth in politics, was to develop with other comrades here and in Italy a notion of class composition during the time when I was involved with Zero Work many, many years ago. And I just wanted to bring out to you a number of levels. When you try to talk about class composition, it's not a simple thing, and it's not something you get from a census, right? Finding out who's doing what. It involves a number of levels, including the analysis of struggles, their content, direction, how they develop and circulate. They involve figuring out the fact that the working class is never one thing. It's many things, and it's always divided, and often divided against itself in hierarchies. Many of these divisions we call racism, sexism, ageism, all the monsterisms that we struggle with every day. These are parts of the divisions of the working class that you always have to become recognize as part of the composition of the working class. It's never one thing. Okay. You have to also recognize that the working class also has many official organizations that express or claim to express its interests and its views. And in fact, there's often, if you want to understand the class composition, you have to understand that there's invariably a struggle with these organizations and invariably an attempt to go beyond them and outside them. It's a crucial part of the story. And finally, we have to understand that capital is always involved in dealing with this class composition, breaking it down, creating new barriers, creating new divisions and hierarchies. It's a continual struggle, right? Which has many sides to it. And it's most important to recognize that there is a technical side to this analysis, but there's also a political side to this analysis. Because the technical side you can try to figure out by looking at the different skills and capacities that branches of production and reproduction require, along with the constant capital they work with. That is, this technical division occurs in mass factories, in small workshops, in the home, in institutions like high-tech hospitals or research universities like this. This technical composition can have a positive or negative impact on the capacity of workers to organize and struggle, that is, on the political composition of the working class. Political composition consists of the forms of organization, some open and formal, others covert and informal, at times illegal, and demands and self-definition on the different sectors of the working class. The technical composition can have tremendous impact on the organization's impossible range of political demands and self-definitions. The classic example of this is Sergio Bologna's analysis of how skilled workers tend to counsel communist forms of politics, while mass workers tend towards the politics of immediate results and a rejection of the self-repression of negotiating contracts with the IWW as its model. In other words, this is an analysis that applies Marxism to working class itself, recognizes that it's not only capitalism that is shaped by the forms of production, but the working class itself. So it's a kind of self-application of Marxism to the analysis of struggle against capital. So this is another thing. Now, there is we're still on time for another few minutes, and I'll be done here. And now that we've sort of laid out the table of class composition and its different parts, to recognize that there are different aspects of class composition, and when class composition becomes dangerous, it has to be attacked. And capital always tries to develop strategies that decompose the working class, redivide it, reduce its power, put barriers to workers getting together, creating hierarchies where they didn't exist before. This notion of decomposition is—it sounds like it. It's death. Huh? It's the death of the working class. And then, of course, poof! There is another moment in the story. There's composition, decomposition, and then there's recomposition. There's the possibility that after a defeat, there's a reorganization of the class, and this reorganization creates new possibilities new levels of power, overcoming many divisions and barriers to that had been previously set. So this notion of recomposition is really quite crucial. And in fact, one of the big questions for us that we have to deal with is, does this crisis signal the moment of a recomposition? And again, let's just finish up a couple of other notions that I need to use. I use when I look at struggles. It's the circulation or communication of struggles. Commonalities between the class composition of different sectors lead to a series of similar strikes, demonstrations, riots, rebellions, and even revolutions. But crucial compositional differences between workers in particular struggle and the surrounding social space can lead to a struggle's isolation and defeat. And this is very important when you begin to, when you launch, when you read a struggle, if you want to see where its possibilities are, often you begin to have to recognize where are the other similar areas of class composition that can respond or in some way or other resonate with it. And if you don't see it, then there's a good chance for the defeat of the struggle, however powerful, however however revolutionary its intent. Okay. And a cycle of struggle. A cycle of struggle arises when particular struggles circulate to other locales where the class composition is such that workers recognize these demands. The modes of organization of the previous moments in the cycle and go into action. When others hear and identify themselves with the struggle, then you have the possibility of creating a cycle of struggles. The cycle expands the series of struggles and their commonalities as well until they lead to a revolutionary transformation or are exhausted. An example of a cycle of struggle is the international cycle of struggle known as 68, from the Prague Spring to the workers' students' insurrection in France to the city insurrections in the United States. Cycles of struggle are broken by decomposition in the elements of the class composition that made it possible for there to be communication of struggles. After a period of successful decomposition, a new cycle of struggle can only be launched with the recomposition of the working class. Okay. So these are the themes, the terms that I use when I look to read the struggles. And this is the last few months with many other comrades around, involved with Midnight Notes or friends of Midnight Notes, we've been trying to get together to get a sense of how we can apply analysis like this to the crisis and begin to see if there are limits to this type of analysis as well as we're going into this. So I just wanted to say a few more words and then in another 5 minutes or so, and then we'll have 45 minutes for discussion. Okay. The first thing that we have been trying to do is to begin to break through the kind of the smoke screen that has surrounded the contemporary crisis. A smoke screen that often confuses all of us because it's put in the form of money, it's put in the form of derivatives, it's put in the form of schemes that are involved, insurance schemes of various sorts, a whole set of terminology that comes from the world of finance that we think is the, we're being told is the way in which we can analyze this crisis. And of course, our argument has been, if there is a capitalist crisis, it's a crisis that has arisen out of struggles. And so what we have been trying to do is to specify the kinds of struggles that have been the source of this crisis, and because in a way we can't take crises as somehow accidents that have arisen that just periodically return from because of the nature of capitalism. Crises are, as we increasingly see, are the products of struggles and are responses to struggles, and so. We need to start with the struggles to understand the crisis, and not start with the crisis to understand the struggles. Because we have as an axiom that all deep changes in capitalist society are caused by the way it imposes exploited work and realizes profit not to meet people's needs, but for investment and the endless reimposition of more and more alienated work, its preferred method of organizing our lives, and the struggle of those who resist this imposition, demanding to live to work to live rather than living to work, and who try to craft alternatives to capital's global work machine. It's out of these struggles that we are looking as the soil for this crisis. And we find, and when you look, instead of looking at the blogs of the investment bankers and investment analysts, we've been looking at the struggles that have been going on, and they've been hidden. Very powerful struggles. They're right in front of our eyes. And my reading is that we don't see these struggles as causing the greatest victory of capital has been its ability to have us not see these struggles as the source of its problems. That's been so. We know that one of the great failures that has been the product of a tremendous amount of struggle is the failure of neoliberal globalization's institutional changes. They have not been able to impose structural adjustment. They have not been able to impose the World Trade Organization agenda. It's been attacked again and again across the planet for decades. And as a consequence, this failure has been an important source of slowing down this process of accumulation. There's clearly been a failure to use war to take over and transform, to privatize the oil and energy sector of the planet. This, we see it, right? We've been seeing a war around energy and oil in Iraq. We've been seeing the struggle that has gone on there. But it's not only there. It's going on in many other parts of the world where the attempt to privatize oil and gas, other forms of energy, have failed. And it's had a big impact upon capital. And a few more. The inability to control wage struggles, especially in China. This has been a very crucial question. And it's been crucial for us especially. The rise of movements that have refused to go away once capital and its agencies have said, you leave your land. People have refused again and again to leave their lands, and they've been very powerful. They've created powerful struggles, ranging from the Niger Delta all throughout the Americas. It's been crucial. These are the struggles out of which this crisis comes from. There have been struggles here in the United States, in fact, to make demands, to demand by workers, to demand, okay, if you're not going to give me my wages, I need to live, I need to educate my children, I need to have the ability to move, the very basic needs. If I can get them, if I can't get them with my wages, I'll get them through credit. This has been a demand on by workers in the United States to deal with the very basic requirements of life, and this has put capital as well in crisis. Okay. Because I think that we must be careful of moralism when we deal with credit. Okay, credit and debt have been sources of class struggle for thousands of years, and one of our friends here has been charting this struggle. It's really basic, and many of us have forgotten this really basic thing. So we must also recognize that as a consequence of this crisis, there's been an enormous explosion in the last year and a half of struggles, very visible struggles. But there's also been a lot of struggles all across the planet. Not so many here, but below the surface, we are beginning to hear of those struggles. We're now beginning to hear of the struggles around, for example, Take Back the Land people, who are bringing homeless people back into houses that have been foreclosed. We hear of Boston City Life. We hear of a variety of initiatives that are taking place on the West Coast. These are just beginning to surface, and they're going to be very, very important in the so-called resolution of the foreclosure crisis in the United States. We're only beginning to apply the ABCs of class analysis to the crisis of, that we're going through. It's a crucial task, not only for those, for the understanding of the crisis, but also it's a crucial task for our, for ourselves. This is our task for the day. So there's a lot to do, and I join you, and you join us. Thanks. Okay, folks, there's a lot to say. There's also been a struggle yesterday, I believe, in the new school. Some of you, I'm sure, have had some experience of that. There are many struggles that I've just that I know all of you are involved in.
When you were talking about the communication and circulation of struggles, made me think that in a way that how do I put it? I guess I should have thought of a question before I raised my hand. I guess it seems that in the way that we analyze capital, the other side of of the antagonist, we think of the logic of growth of capital, and in a way, struggles also have their own logic of growth through the communication and circulation of struggle, and that perhaps they're also, like a falling rate of compositional struggle. This is just hearing you talk about it, made me think about it. What do you think about that?
Let's put it this way. What we're doing here is that we're, it's also been a problem of Marxism as a whole. Marx did a great job 150 years ago, charting out and spending a tremendous intellectual energy and bringing many other energies to task to analyze capital. But that task has not been followed by the task of analyzing working class struggle. Mm-hmm. If you look at Marx, I mean, you know, I'm a lover of Marx, I must say, and I've learned a lot from him. And often I pump him up, say Marx has got the struggle always on his mind. And he does. But the refinement of analysis that he used to analyze capital versus the refinement of analysis that he used to understand working class struggle is really dimensions apart. This is my humble view, and I'm willing to hear others. And I know I have comrades who think otherwise. But this, I think, is very important. So when you're trying, one of the aspects of our problem politically often is that we study capital a lot, but often we don't have a chance to study class struggle. And we often don't have the kind of the rubrics even. Right? Of how to do it.
Yeah.
You see what, and here's what you're, what I hear you're trying to do is to say, okay, can we find in these struggles some way of characterizing them that would be, that would
help
catch
us
them,
understand.
Make us understand and see. This is very important, but it's a job that is still waiting to be done. And it's something that is vital to be done, it seems to me. Partly because, of course, things have changed tremendously since Marx's time. The notion of the working class that we use now has no resemblance it's you know, when we say struggles in the bedroom have now become part of the class struggle, we're extending, when we begin to say it's crucial for us to understand what the struggles of students are doing to transforming that, we're expanding in that direction. When we say, okay, it's important to understand criminality, because if you only look at contractual wage workers and their struggles, as we know, I mean, I don't have to beat a dead horse. I mean, it's a very small part of this large, right? So this is how I would say, so I'm not sure in terms of how you're trying to formulate it, but it's true, when you try to see when is there circulation, okay, for example, we've had an arc of struggles in the last few months, right, in Europe, that are clearly in response to the crisis. But those types of struggles have not appeared here. How come?
You mean like in Greece?
Yeah, Greece, Ireland, Iceland, Latvia, France, Italy, Spain. In other words, you can do a nice way of identifying the kinds of struggles, and in fact, comrades who've got, you know that there are some comrades who've been not in all of them, but there have been in a number of them. There have been clear cases of circulation and communication of struggles, right? But now, one important question is, why not here? Yeah. For us sitting here, but there are clearly struggles going on here, but they're of a different kind, right? So it's, yeah.
I think to a certain extent, because we have had years and years and years of just kind of getting used to, or in Europe, for example, they don't, like, neoliberalism hasn't taken effect as much as, like, in the United States, where everything is privatized here, where, like, we've had to deal with, like, 30 plus years of, like, very, very crappy economics, and that's put us in the situation in the first place. Do you think that has something to do with it, just, like, the sheer aggressive nature that we have, like, in the United States?
Aggressive nature here?
I mean, like, the capitalist system is obviously very, very aggressive.
Yes, indeed, yes. Okay. So you're saying, in order to understand the limits, well, I would say one of the questions is to begin to understand, in my presentation, we would have to do this type of analysis that is before us. We have to understand a bit of the class composition in the United States versus Europe.
Yeah.
All right, to see that. Because remember, the intuition behind this is pretty clear. In other words, do you get power from every struggle that's going on around you? Some you get power from because you see yourself in it. You see what I mean? And so the question is, why is it that in some can see themselves and get power from struggles outside of one's own situation, and where you don't? Okay. And so one of the questions, one of the issues that you're posing is, well, is has has neoliberalism so destroyed the types of class connections, the kind of path, the type of power that people have built over the years, has the disintegration process gone to a greater extent than has gone in Europe? Well, that's one that is definitely a possibility that one can draw from. But on the other side, that leads to a further question: What's new in our situation that's going to transform? Right, because it's never a given. In other words, that's important to see that when we begin to talk this way, we're not sociologists, right? We're not interested in a sociological analysis. It might help us, it might be interesting, it might But in general, what we're interested in is to see an analysis that will make it possible to be part of a recomposition process. Right? It's not enough to just say, oh, we've been ground down by a capitalist initiative, and here we are. Okay? We need to begin to see, where is it? Is it, for example, in the movement of homeless people into foreclosed homes that is the beginning of a process of recomposition? Or not? All right?
Yeah. A lot of the times when people are discussing this, I know that Tronti wrote an essay recently where he's saying the weird thing about this particular crisis is he thought there wasn't that same degree of antagonism and struggle leading up to it. And this was kind of shocking coming from one of the guys who actually originally came up with this formulation. Where I am, there's a lot of debate about this, because one of the arguments is that the Reagan-Thatcher period, the sort of New Deal after they broke the Keynesian link between wages and productivity, that you can't have more wages for more productivity, instead you can have credit, and then you can have, there's the idea of investing in the system itself, there's 401ks, there's mortgage refinancing, so forth and so on. And we'd hit a certain point of saturation where you just couldn't, where you couldn't expand the illusion that people could actually buy their way into capitalism anymore. It was all kind of a scam and finally collapsed. People were saying, well, you can use that interpretation, but where's the element of class struggle? It sounds like people were just buying in and it didn't work. And other people have suggested that you can look at what happened as more like a credit strike. People just stopped paying their credit card bills. The whole thing collapsed because of this sort of passive resistance. I'm just trying to think how you think, what you respond to that is. Because there's a whole discourse right now about people saying, well, the antagonism argument, how do you even make it here? And it's possible that it's because they're just being very Eurocentric about it. That seems the obvious response. But I just wanted to...
I would start, of course, there, because there's a big world, and we've been part of a movement that, I mean, that's been the glory of our time, right? Mm-hmm. That we've been able to be part of a movement that does encompass, goes from India to Bolivia to to Nigeria to Switzerland, right? That's been a tremendous power, and that's been crucial. I just remind everybody of this mm-hmm. point and what that has meant from the point of view of capitalism. But that, just to speak to this, the second point that you made, mm-hmm. It seems to me that what's going on is that when we have to be careful about not framing the present situation as a victim, as the working class as victim. Okay, which is often the way it's presented. Passive, duped, right? It's a little bit like what happened with welfare, right? In the 1970s, right? What do we have? The welfare queen and who was scheming to get what is not appropriate, that she should not get, right? And on the other side, the welfare worker who is sort of kind of winking an eye and letting this pass. Okay, that framework has been basic to the attack on welfare that took place in the 70s and 80s, and eventually led to the end of welfare as we know it in the United States and the kind of guarantees that it used to have. So we have to be careful in this crisis not to fall into the same type of, because we're already beginning to have that. That story. The story is, we have the unscrupulous, often black or Hispanic person who is on the one side trying to make a fast deal, or on the other side, someone who is a complete victim, who is kind of just duped by the shyster mortgage brokers and so on and so forth. These are the images that we are being presented. And I would say, just for a finish a minute.
Yeah.
Okay, good, thanks. I would say it's very important to counter these images. Because what's going on is that the workers in the United States have been saying, we need to live, we need a house at this point, we need to be able to get our commodities. How often have we seen people pay for food with a credit card in whenever you rent it? We need to be able to educate our kids, because we're told that without education they'll be in real trouble. And we need to, in fact, at this point, have some way of getting around, because the United States, I mean, you get out of New York and a few other places, and if you don't have a way of getting around, you're finished. Okay, so you need access to an automobile. These are basic, and basically the working class has been struggling to get these things. It's not like a big deal. And if it's a struggle that now involves debt and credit instead of wage and profit, so be it. And as I said, if you look at the history of class struggles going back to Rome and before, there it is. So I would say let's expand our minds a little bit. Yes, Marx said debt and credit was not appropriate for the working class, but that changed many decades ago. So I would say it's important for us to reject a certain kind of moralism that is also within the left, which, remember, is saying, you shouldn't want this, you shouldn't want that, you shouldn't want this, you shouldn't... Well, wait a second. These are not just arbitrary wants that are being negotiated when you want to have a place to live, right? This is not an arbitrary want when you want to feed your kids. I mean, and you're going to struggle in any way you can to find the ways to do it. So it's important that, yes, there's a deal going on, of course, around this, and it's not a happy deal, and it can lead to debt peonage, which in fact for many has happened. But it also can lead to, for example, debt moratoriums, debt jubilees as well. And in fact, there's a struggle going on in this country as to how it's going to happen. Right? The game is far from over. And it's important for us here to not take the bait, as far as I see, and accept the way in which it's being formulated. So that's part, David. All hats off to Signor Tronti, and I love him, and I understand.
Yeah.
I understand his. But you know, this is not the first time he said this. It goes back to his rejection of a certain conception of class struggle that he almost defined. Sorry, here just for a little Mario Tronti, the Italian theorist of class struggle, workers and capital, that were in the mid-60s. It was like basic education for many people like myself. But by the late 60s, he was already saying, class struggle, no, it's not going to actually gonna do the job. So by the beginning of, by the end of the first decade of the 20th century, I'm not surprised that this is what he's saying. I just humbly disagree, and I think that it's important for us to not accept the type of fetishism that makes us blind to seeing our own power. Yeah.
I think it's easy to kind of say we have to reject this notion that the working class is a victim, but at the same time, I feel that, you know, the same grounding in economics that many of us in this room have, and the fact that we are aware of the economic forces that caused this crisis and that caused, you know, this worker to not be able to pay his mortgage or to not be able to pay his credit card bill, you know, I think we are aware of those things because we study these things and we kind of have a preference to, you know, study these things. But I do feel that, because it has also affected my family, and they have no real, maybe it's just my family, I'm pretty sure it's not an isolated incident, but I feel that a lot of the quote-unquote working class is kind of not really aware of what the general economics are, of what, you know, what would cause something like this to happen, like you know, if I try to mention to my family that, you know, this is the nature of capitalism, you know, Marx said predicted these kinds of things 150 years ago, blah blah blah. You know, they kind of like think. I mean, I don't know. They just kind of don't really. They don't really feel that there's an economic system that caused this. They just feel that they're not able to pay their mortgage, and that's really what's most important to them right now. And it's interesting in the sense that it also breeds kind of an opportunity to say, you know, to actually say this is not just a random occurrence. It happened 30 years ago. It happened 30 years before that. It happened 30 years before that. You know, it's part of the cycle of capital. And as long as we keep playing into this cycle with all these new contraptions that they give us, be it credit, be it whatever system they try to get you to, you know, like mm-hmm. you said, buy into capitalism, as long as we keep doing that and then suffering the consequences 10 years later when that bubble drops, pops, then, you know, I'm just wondering to what extent does the modern working class feel that they were, you know, victimized, or whether they are actually capable of affecting change as part of a larger economic system that caused the actual crisis itself.
Okay.
Because I know that in my family, yeah. you know, like I was saying, and a lot of other mm-hmm. people I've talked to whose families have been affected, just, you know, regular working class mm-hmm. people that aren't necessarily aligned with Marxism or aligned with the left, or, you know, who really have nothing to do with it, and they really have no deep interest of really getting involved on that level, on that ideological level, even though there is kind of that passive resistance, like we mentioned, of people just not paying their credit card bills.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I would argue that I don't really know if I would even call it passive resistance, because it's really just like, well, I just don't have the money to pay my credit card bill. So it's not like I'm saying, you know, screw these credit card companies. Like, if I did have the money, I would very gladly pay my credit card bill. So I think that's one of the problems that we're kind of, and what makes this crisis unique is that I don't know whether it's a product of 30 plus years of neoliberalism, like we've been saying, or whatever, but I feel that the forces of capital have expanded to such an extent that the working class itself has kind of bought into it, and they're kind of like, the mentality is, we don't need to get rid of capitalism, we need to change capitalism to make it work better, or so that we don't have to deal with these crises, or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. At least, that's the experience that I've had. I don't know if people have had different
Do people want to respond to
you? Yeah.
Okay, so, Melissa, you want to respond, and then
yeah.
go.
What you just said about, if I had the money, I would pay my credit card bill. I think it's a good idea, if anybody has the time, to go to your local courthouse and where they are adjudicating credit card bills for people who have gotten court summonses, and listen to what people were talking about and what being said. I think that what you said possibly could have been the average free thinking maybe 6 months ago, but I think things are changing very, very, very fast. I think the people, I went there with a friend who had a court summons. That hopefully, you know, they do 100 people at a time, or they do like 40 people, depending
right.
how, you know, they got six creditors, they just divide everybody up. And the when people have gone through watching what's been going on for the last couple months, and they owe $25 or whatever, $1,000 on their credit card, and more than, you know, like 80% of it is interest,
right.
then they may have wanted to make their payments, and they can make their payments, but at this point, everybody's gotten bailed out. They knew what their original bill was. They know they've been charged 28% or whatever interest for all these months. They think that's total bullshit. You know, and if they watch the court take the credit card bill and more than have it, which the court does, and that's a deal for the banks and the credit card companies, if they can get half of it, they're happy. So then people say, no, how about 20%? And some people get that. And everybody thinks, wow. That's interesting. So, you know, the people who don't go to court don't even know that. They're still dutifully paying their credit card.
Right. Right.
But if you get the summons, you go down there, they'll gladly take half or less. Anyway, I think people's minds are really changing quickly because of what's going on. And partially it's because they hear what's happening to other people's adjudication of their debt. It's what they see on what's happening to the Treasury. and bailing out everybody, and all of the rules of the game, and what is it, you know, I would pay it if I could, I would pay my mortgage if I could, what's fair, why I want to be a good citizen, blah, blah, all of those things are up in the air.
Right.
So, to respond to what you just said.
Yeah, yeah, no, and mm-hmm. I hope you're right. Yeah.
So I think others want to, do you want to?
I wanted to tie it back to something we were talking about earlier too, though. I think there's something particular about the United States too, that this ideological bombardment that we've seen since the initiation of the Cold War, and then just the end of it, where it was decided that Marxism is dead, and Great Britain was really the United States said, all right, we don't actually need to engage these people on Marxism and other questions. These questions that we totally resolved, and partially the ruling classes inside of this, because all of our struggles have been. Like, not all of our struggles, obviously, are here, and obviously, you know, there's been struggles outside of capitalism, but so much of our effort and energy has been pushed into making the system stronger, and all of our struggles have been pushed into how can we make capitalism, you know, that image of the best possible world. You know, the idea of there being another world being possible, is crushing of so many people, and there are parts of that put into, you know, let's strengthen social security, let's strengthen, let's get health care going on in the United States. And, I think that all of these things are so closely tied together, why it's different in other countries than it is in the United States, is that ideological environment can be more massive than anywhere else in human history. And I'm not just talking about systematic education, but, you know.
No, advertising.
I mean American Idol, too. I mean, all these, every single facet of the media, you know, it's not, you know, it's laissez-faire. It's not like they're leading down this command order to be doing this, but it functions in keeping us restrained in the system. And I think that that's really where this meets some of what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. I found fascinating what you're saying. I never thought about this. I don't know if I like it, but I find it fascinating.
I don't know if I like it either.
But I mean, I've looked at this crisis as very much a crisis of production, a crisis in that you're basically anarchy, not the way we use it, but anarchy way they organize themselves. And they, you know, class struggles, there's our class, and then they have class struggles as well, and their class is struggling amongst themselves. To always figure out which way is best to produce and exploit, move forward, organize the world. And, you know, there, this is very much like the neoliberal question facilitated of the period of history, but now it's, you know, it's raising more of a question, and they're, you know, now we're having this crisis, and they're going to come out with new conclusions. But I think that the main thing we need to be doing is figuring out how we can make all of our struggles, even if we engage in, you know, a struggle to particularly benefit a person's individual situation, how can we link that struggle with the need for breaking out of this system, or the raising of consciousness? Because that was thrown off the table after the 70s, frankly.
Yeah.
You know, look, we need to have immediate solutions to people's real problems. We need to bring that very quickly, very harshly back. You know, people in the last program talked about the Black Panther struggle, and, you know, just breakfast programs and these things. Those were great, but the reason the Black Panthers were so great is because they were linking the need for revolution with those daily needs. And that's what really needs to be done, just to start breaking down this. Maybe we don't have enough time to do it. Frankly, we should have been doing it since the 80s, but I don't think we're fucked yet.
Okay, do you want to say something again?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, for the first time in my lifetime, I grew up and not that well off background, as many people, probably some people here have. And I've been actually for the first time able to discuss with my mom, for example, about like class politics without immediately being turned off by like her being turned off by the language that
right. The
radical left does use, which has been really, really awesome. And I've talked to like many of her coworkers, because like her and I are fairly close about it, and you know, there has been a definite like shift within the past 6 months of my interests are not within theirs, and we don't have the same interests. After they saw the bailout, after how many people aren't getting the help that they need, so I think there is definitely like big possibilities with this. But I think, again, like, we have had, like, such a, back to your point, such a stigmatizing of how we talk, if we do talk about class struggle, if we do talk about, like, advancing, like.
Okay, yep.
I wanted to
Speak a lot of.
Marx, you know, had a lot of important analysis about capitalism and how it works and screw people over, and but not so much how to actually respond to that effectively. Maybe that means not known. That's not necessarily his forte. You know, but I'm not. I'm just saying. In their own way. But he also talked about something called false consciousness, right? You know, it's like capitalist consciousness, controlled consciousness, as opposed to a revolutionary consciousness, which I think a lot of us are interested in, and, you know, this being the end of this book fair. And now with the modern media, you know, the capitalist media is very much invested in breaking down that revolutionary potential and is selling us that, you know, false consciousness of buying into capitalism and everything. So I feel like that's a front of struggle that's really important. And this whole like bursting of the bubble, all they really want to do is build a new bubble and not necessarily, you know, whereas we want to sort of build a movement. But you use that word decomposing before, which kind of strikes a chord when you say, hey, what's wrong with the and the thing is, you said the workers are the organic part of the capitalist machine or structure, but not if their brains have been co-opted to the point where they've surrendered that consciousness to capitalism. So again, I mean, sort of, you know, that's a point that I'm going to make, but and that's why people lack that systemic critique. But I think a lot of this is about power and realizing our power. I think a lot of people know that they're screwed, and excuse my French, but I mean, when you're getting fucked, I think you kind of pick up on it, and a lot of this is exactly what's happening, and people get it, but there's a sense of powerlessness. It's like, yeah, okay, we all recognize the cancer, but what's the cure? And like, you take the Greek model, just quickly wrap this up, and compare that to the United States. It's like, where is the rage? Why is it repressed here? How come the workers and the students and the anarchists aren't getting together and like really unleashing that? And we just don't see that on this level. It's built glimpses and pockets of potential, which is better than nothing. But so, I mean, that to me is like the discussion I really like to, why aren't we realizing our potential?
Well, I know that there are other, and I'm not exactly sure what time is it now.
10 to 6.
Okay, let me just say a few things that might connect up with both of your comments. Remember, one of the first things that I said about reading struggles is that, first and foremost, struggles almost invariably do not describe themselves as struggles. Rarely do you have the power to say that what you're doing is a struggle. So when you look at the history of working class struggle for centuries, you'll see that tremendous amount of energy, subversion has been going on, but not part of the process of taking off, you know, like the superheroes who take off their, you know, their clothes and say, oh, here I am. But there is an ongoing process, and that's important to check out, to see, because it's something, for example, when someone says, makes decisions that, for example, leads to buying a house, let's say, that with a kind of a shaky kind of possibility of a mortgage that might balloon in interest. Yeah. All right. When you make that risky move, all right, you also are operating on a very basic principle, which is, and it is a revolutionary principle. It's saying, I and my family deserve a place to live. That is not making me sick and making them sick. It's a very basic. It's expressing a revolutionary demand in our society, which is saying, we need to live somewhere. This is a place where we can live. I'll take a risk, okay? Workers are not so stupid in that sense. I mean, they might not be revolutionaries, okay, that's not what I'm saying, but they do recognize that what needs are, and recognize that they can struggle with the system at great risk, because workers are always at risk. You get a wage, but you don't get a guaranteed wage, right? You get a job, you're exploited, on top of it, you're exploited, and then when you're finished with you, they throw you out. Okay, so it's not like the wage is also a place of great riskiness in what you do. So, but within the wage struggle, we see a revolutionary possibility all the time. All right. So what I'm trying to say, in terms of the question of credit and debt that's going on here, is that within that area as well, there's workers are taking risks on the basis of what I interpret as a fundamentally revolutionary demand, which says housing is all right, and we're going to get it by any means necessary.
Mentioned war before. I actually think it is appropriate to think that we are at war, and maybe our goal should be annihilation of the enemy, because we're not really interested in coexisting in a dynamic of domination and subjugation. We want real freedom.
Well, that's not for us to decide. Let's put it this way. In other words, you're in a war not because you declare it, but because, in fact, the situation is such.
Should we recognize it as such?
Well, that's something for you to you, that's something for us to work through and begin to investigate in our struggles. We can begin to see, have we reached the point where there is power to change the situation where, in fact, we become part of it, and another type of, where the antagonism stops and we go beyond the point of the antagonism. And that's something that's called, used to be called revolution or the mutual annihilation of the classes, because there's always that possibility too. Mutual annihilation, in fact, is not an unknown part of class struggle. Okay, so I would say it's the rhetoric is one thing. When one is in the middle of a struggle, you don't really parse the term. Is it war? Is it a fight? Is it this? Is it that? But what I'm trying to do is that I'm trying to say that in fact much of the struggles that go on in the society are struggles in that sense. They're agons. They're contests between two antagonists that, at the end of which, in most cases, they're both around. And the question is, can we reach a point where, in fact, that will change? Now, that's something, as I said, it's not something that one can just decide for oneself. One can want it, okay, but you can't.
Wanting informs your approach to it.
Yeah, it does inform it, yes, but it doesn't change it, all right? I think we got it too.
This process you've been describing of struggle between capital and working class, and the economy's nature of working class struggle, it seems like it could go on forever. It's been going on for 500 years. And what I don't see in your analysis is an endpoint. What I'm curious about is, if I don't see it, perhaps you do, how this results in the defeat of capitalism and the establishment of a decentralized society. This is an anarchist conference, and I think most people in the room probably want the decentralized new form of society. And how can that result from struggles where people don't even see that they're struggling? In other words, that would be an unconscious struggle, right?
Well, that's one way of describing it, yeah.
And so doesn't there have to be an explicit struggle for to defeat capitalism and establish society?
At some point, yes. The question is, do you have the power to launch such struggles? And that, in other words, have you developed what we would call, has the working class developed its level of homogeneity? In other words, broken up its division? After all, the biggest, what holds us back? Of course, it's the nuclear weapons and so on and so forth. But the real thing that holds us back has been the divisions within ourselves, right? That's really basic. Now, once you begin to transcend these divisions, once you go beyond racism, sexism, ageism, and once you begin to create a unified class of a sort that has been described by visionaries in past times, once you enter into that realm, then you begin to get into a different world, right? As I would say, yes, of course, that's the path of recomposition is the only path to take, and that's the goal. But I would say we have to also recognize and have a language to also recognize it's not so much only a question of unconscious. There's also another realm. I mean, I'm not sure how you would measure it, but there's a tremendous amount of activities that we would call struggles that are not recognized, that people don't speak up. It's unspoken, but are recognized as struggles. You see, and now you're saying, well, as long as a struggle doesn't identify itself as a struggle, it's not a struggle. Here, I don't know if you would say that, but I would say, there's nothing wrong with being in that status, all right?
My question was, how can that possibly lead to the overthrow of capitalism and the establishment of
him? It could lead because this struggle can change the relations of power in such a way that the relations of power are less against you, okay? And you begin to make it possible to speak, to speak the name of struggle while you're struggling, okay? Now that transformation process is something that we all have been through personally. We all know that there's a certain point where your own power in a situation is transformed, to that finally you can say, ah, what I'm doing now is saying no to you. Whereas the no was said before, but it was unspoken. Now, when you go from the unspoken no to the no that shouts out no, okay, that transformation it's not a magical process, okay? It's a process that requires a tremendous amount of political thought, political action, a lot of risk, and also recognition that many people around us are not yet ready for it, and being able to give them the type of power to say the no and not just simply act the no. Because you're right, there'll be a certain point where you can't make any more progress towards a revolutionary transformation until you begin to speak it. You're quite right. In that sense, the word and the act must come together. But to demand the word and act before they are together is to often call for the defeat of both word and act. This would be my view. Thank you. Yeah.
I wanted to ask another question about credit and debt. I think you suggested earlier that perhaps the terrain of struggle has shifted at least partially from the realm of wages and profit to the realm of debt and credit. And it seems like that raises some interesting possibilities, but also some important problems. Because debt appears to be a strictly individual phenomenon. A person is given a personal credit history, which seems to be individualized. Even if you go through the court process and get your debt re-adjudicated or whatever, the court system tends to fragment the working class into pieces. Whereas it seems that wages are more obviously a collective phenomenon. And I think that, at least in the short term, resistance to debt is likely to result in retrenchment on the part of capital in the form of higher interest rates, in the form of denying loans. We've already seen that. I mean, for every person who's able to get their debt reduced by 80%, there's someone else who's been denied a college loan or can't get the credit card they want. And I think in the absence of real serious struggle, I'm not very hopeful that the struggle over debt is going to be a productive one.
Let's put it this way. I didn't choose this type of struggle, okay? In other words, I just am trying to name it and trying to understand it, okay? What I would like to point out, though, of course, in our society, wages also, aside from whenever we have a union contract, But most workers are operating outside of union contracts, and most workers are negotiating their own wages. So in that sense, the notion of the wage of capitalism, especially in its neoliberal form, has developed, has been, in fact, to individualize the wage. That's also been true. So I would say that particular issue is applies as well to wages. But also on the other side, this is not right now. For example, there are legislative efforts to, number one, for example, write off a lot of debt uniformly, and usury laws, the reintroducing of usury laws that would put limits on interest. These are, so to speak, legislative acts that are in some way or other depending upon a collective response from the working class. And we'll see how that works out. These are struggles that we don't know where they'll go. But what I've been saying is that this is a struggle that has been put on our laps by workers around the world, right? And especially in the United States. In other words, debt has become, look, so much of the struggle of in Mexico, in Central America, has been struggle around debt, right? Debt peonage has been such a fundamental issue, and it's been a basic issue all over the world, and it still remains a basic issue all over the world to this day. So what I'm suggesting is that let's apply some of these categories to ourselves. Humble. These categories might be old, and they might be humiliating or humbling, but in fact we should recognize them and make demands. Remember, the anti-globalization movement was also an anti-debt movement, right? We were saying it was wrong for peasants in Nigeria to begin paying the debt of a corrupt general that had been in power and made deals with the IMF and the World Bank. This was our demand. Now, what is it that we want to defend workers in New Jersey who have gone into debt as well? We would, of course.
I agree with you in principle, but I think that the difference is that, at least in the United States, there's no mass movement for debt forgiveness that's willing to say its own name.
Yet.
Yeah. Let's see what happens.
There hasn't been much of a U.S. anti-capitalist movement.
Yeah.
Sure. I actually just wanted to address, you said yourself that you felt like some of the Marxist modes of looking at things might be slightly outdated. So, I kind of, it seems to me like it sort of does a disservice to, I don't want to say struggle, because quite honestly, I'm more interested in, like, what by your definition is war, including, like, annihilation of both parties, in the sense that I feel like if there is going to be a proletariat, or a proletariat, it should be to annihilate the ruling class and then annihilate itself as a class. So I'm just wondering, do we do a disservice then to struggles all over the world by trying to fit them into this framework of worker versus non-worker? Because it seems to me, especially like in the United States recently, when you look at Oakland, for instance, mm-hmm. Like the Lavelle Nixon thing, like a lot of people demonstrating in the streets for that would be traditionally considered part of like the woman proletariat and Marxists, which is a counter-revolutionary class. So by saying, in my personal opinion, when the subject of history in general has changed, is it really valid to then say that still the only real revolutionary subject is the workers?
Well, okay, let me just respond to you in a short way, because we need... First, capitalism is the way in which I name the contemporary system of power and exploitation that exists. So, when you have capitalism, it would be axiomatic that capital, in order to accumulate, needs to exploit workers.
Right.
So capital and worker, so I put them together. Now, the second point I just wanted to make, these are very cutting questions, and I need to respond to them perhaps as briefly as I can. But I wanted to say, the notion, what has developed since Marx's time, has been many revolutions within thinking about what it is that makes one a worker in a capitalist society. And it's tremendously expanded. Now, some have said this has done a disservice to Marx. Well, perhaps it has been. But there's been a theoretical and a practical and a political revolution within Marxism itself.
Right.
And now, we're not yet beyond capital, right? So therefore, those changes have not done the job, you might say. So one has to thrash any theory that doesn't do the job, okay?
Right.
So in that sense, I would say, yes, there's clearly a lot missing. There's a lot of work to be done. So, but I would just say, just simply to you, that these are the categories that I, and I think a lot of other people, use to understand the way in which the struggle takes place in this society.
Right.
And when that struggle accumulates and begins to grow in power beyond the possibilities of the society, then in fact we do speak of the end of the process.
Yes, the two responses from that I would turn back to that are, just to start with, I mean, it just strikes me then, you know, where do people who aren't part of the capitalist system that are being, like, the capitalist system is attempting to assimilate, like, where would they fall into that? As oppressed people who do have revolutionary power. I mean, for instance, like, in like New Guinea, like indigenous people there resisting colonialism, is that not revolutionary? Is that not struggle? Like, that would be the main point there,
yeah.
I guess. And then the other point would be, I think it's been demonstrated before by folks like Heidegger, people like that, the general subject of human history at this point isn't humanity anymore. And, you know, some would argue that the capital became the thing. But at that point after that, I would say that it's technological process in general, the capital is just a service to that. So again, at that point, doesn't that really, in a lot of ways, completely sort of throw everything
the book
apart.
Has been opened.
That's
with Heidegger, the book is open. And it's a very tough little book, I'd like to, you know, talk to you about it. I'm here, but I think we all need to get going. Yeah?
We can talk 10 a.m. tomorrow morning.
As well, we'll be around.
So,